this is the segment of this that I'm going to go through real fast and then maybe leave us a few minutes for questions. And just quickly suggest to you the outlines of what it seems to me has happened since 1906. Phase three, the Churches of Christ, which are this separated group of about 125,000 people who say that essentially this movement is going in a direction that we don't agree with, and we're going to separate into conservative congregations, each of which tries to do just what they can find scriptural authority for. During this period, as I suggested, like during the first period, they grew very rapidly. From around 125,000 to, after World War II, about 1.5 million. A much more rapid growth than the Disciples of Christ and the liberal wing of the movement. The reason they grew, there are a lot of different reasons. By the way, in case I don't really get there today, non-institutional Churches of Christ, who are pretty well separated by the 1950s, are growing very rapidly right now for the same kind of reasons. Because there are still people, they're still full of people who believe in the message and who are trying to convert people. And another very interesting reason is because they went and they preached all over the place. If you read my book on Brother Haley and see all the meetings Brother Haley preached and scores, hundreds of people that he baptized. But also, all through this period, there's a migration of people out of Christian churches into Churches of Christ. There's always movement, by the way, across these lines. For a generation, there were people moving out of Churches of Christ, going to Christian churches. But there were many, many more people moving out of Christian churches into Churches of Christ in the 1920s, 1930s, 1940s. Because as these liberal denominations get more and more liberal, people get disgusted with them. And they'll gravitate toward a group that looks more like what their commitment is. So they grew quite rapidly. Now, there were a lot of issues, and there was a lot of debating. If you read the papers in the 1920s, 1930s, 1940s, you just see there are all kinds of questions. Many of them issues that later become divisive. So like issues like whether churches could send support to colleges and other type institutionals. But they were issues among like-minded people. Now, if I can explain that to you and you take that away, it'd be an important point. Lots of times people don't make a distinction between the kinds of ways that people have doctrinal disputes within the movement. We go through periods in which everybody has a singular commitment to saying, we are going to go back and just be New Testament churches. And I'm going to give you the authority for everything that I do. That does not mean that we will all get to exactly the same point on every issue at the same time. Quite to the contrary. So what we have to do is we have to devise exactly what are the limits that we personally and congregationally will tolerate. And that's exactly what happens. And everybody doesn't come to exactly the same place. But those are what I call divisions among like-minded people. And I think that is kind of where we are today. And it's everybody that you encounter will try to tell you that I believe I'm doing exactly what the Scriptures teach. And those are unfortunate. It's unfortunate sometimes the nature of those divisions, but they go with this commitment in the wild democracy to just being New Testament Christians. Sometimes those issues become divisive, as in during these years, there were the one cup issue, the non-class issue, and premillennialism, which I won't discuss unless somebody wants to, were quite divisive, necessarily divisive issues, I think. Premillennialism was divisive basically because, if you know the history of that, in the late 19th century, a new form of premillennialism came along. There have always been forms of premillennialism. But the late 19th century saw the appearance of what is known as dispensational premillennialism. It is the variety that is so widespread in evangelical churches today. And dispensational premillennialism has with it this concept that the church was kind of accidental, that it was interposed because people killed Jesus instead of letting him establish the kingdom when he was here, and consequently God imposed an age, the church age, that was kind of an afterthought, and then Jesus is going to come back and try again. And that is so at odds with our understanding of the church being a part of God's grand plan of bringing people together as his people on earth, that there was no way to accommodate that. So some of those divisions were necessary. Now, the result is that, so that's phase three. Now let me go to phase four. By the way, I was just going to show you that we're about to get to phase four, where we have these three divisions again. It's very similar to up here. These people, by the way, the Christian church people call Churches of Christ people when that division came along. They generally call them antis because they were anti-instrumental music and anti-missionary society. When I first started teaching up in East Tennessee, there were a lot of these people, conservative Christian church guys. And I had a couple of students in my classes working on masters. And they found out that I'd written a book about the Restoration Movement, and they wondered where I belonged in that. And so they finally discovered that I was over here, and one of those boys came to me one day and he said, "Dr. Harrelling," he said, "I understand that you are an anti." And I said, "Son," I said, "you have no idea." I said, "I'm an anti." What we're going to do now then is get to this second phase here. And I want to talk with you about phase four of the Restoration Movement, in which in the years from about 1950 to the present, there has been a three-way division in Churches of Christ. It's very difficult to label these things. And it's also difficult for it not to look denominational. You know, in the first division, there were these three names that had been so widely used that you kind of knew who was what. But today, that is not true. But however, Churches of Christ today are quite seriously separated from each other. The first of those divisions is really the sloughing off of the most conservative wing of the movement, which is exactly what happened before in 1906. And that is a group of people that I, in my books, I call non-institutional Churches of Christ, churches that objected to some of the institutional practices that had been actually going on for a long time. And there is today, in the 1990s, these non-institutional Christians, at that point, by the way, probably represented about 10 or 12% of the movement. About the same as before. The 85 or 90% has undergone a division that is actually taking place right now. And they are pretty thoroughly separated from one another. These separations in our movement, as I say, there's no denominational apparatus. Separations take place when people associate with congregations that are well-defined and when they have kind of loyalties to, you can tell by what papers they read or by what colleges they go to. And most of all, what you can tell, as a preacher can tell, because the time comes when you can't preach across these lines. Now, the present ongoing division in what has long been called mainstream Churches of Christ is between a very liberal group that call themselves progressives, and we'll look at some of the characteristics in just a moment, and another group that I've called institutional churches of Christ, who have, it seems to me, a quite denominational and institutional understanding of who they are, as opposed to conservative people who, it seems to me, have kept the motif alive of just being New Testament Christians. Now, let me just tell you that as churches of Christ spread out and become quite different kinds of churches, some of these are very complicated slides that we don't have time to talk about, but you can never say, well, a division just takes place at this time and in this way, and it's irregular. There are people with mixed loyalties. There are lots of people in churches that I would call institutional churches of Christ, even progressive churches of Christ, who probably don't have much sympathy for what's going on and who would be more comfortable in a non-institutional conservative church. The same thing's true in the other direction. I did this lecture at Abilene just 3 or 4 years ago, and over a much more extended period of time. And a lot of people came. I mean, Royce Money came, the president, and a lot of their faculty and board members. And when I finished one day and had the question period, one of the board members said to me, he said, I've listened to all this stuff that you say. And he said, I believe the same thing you do. And he said, what do you think of that? And I said, well, what I think of that is, I think you're in the wrong box. That is, there are a lot of people in places that I think they're probably in the wrong place. You know, it's interesting in that first division. Take somebody like J.W. McGarvey. J.W. McGarvey associated all his life with disciples, with people in Christian churches. Though, he believed instrumental music was wrong. And if J.W. McGarvey had come back 10 years after he died, they wouldn't have had him preach in any of those churches. He really was in the wrong box, is what he was in. And so what everybody has to make up their mind, I'll tell you, I'm not judgmental at all. Many times people will say to me, oh, well, you're just saying everybody that disagrees with you is going to hell. Well, no, I am not in charge of that. So I can't tell you the answer to that. Now, I made that statement, by the way, one time when I was giving this lecture at Lipscomb, and when I said I'm not in charge of that, I got a big chorus of amens. And they were glad of it, and they had good reason to be glad of it. But anyhow, it's not judgment. I tell you, the judgment you make in this is you decide where you're going to spend your life. You have to spend your life working in the Lord's service somewhere, and what you need to do is you need to find some people who believe the things that you believe about just trying to be a New Testament Christian. And that's the kind of sorting out that we need to do. You need not do it on the basis of who your family is. Or this congregation, I'll tell you, young guys, the time will come when people have all kinds of different loyalties that lead them to be where they are religiously. Some people are loyal to their parents. Well, that's wonderful. If you got good parents, that's a wonderful blessing. But that's not what you're loyal to. Some people are loyal to a congregation. I preached in an old congregation many years ago, beautiful old building. But as far as I could tell, you know, there was nothing alive in it. And I told somebody, I said, you know, this congregation, I think most of these people are just kind of like the pews and the chandeliers. They just go with this building. And whatever happens here, they go with it. Well, that is true. But I will tell you, 10 years from now, 15 years from now, 50 years from now, I have no idea what this congregation will be or what will be in this building. That doesn't make any difference. If your loyalty is to the Lord, that's where your loyalty has to be. And your commitment is to just being a New Testament Christian. And where you need to be is you need to be where there's some folks that want to do that. Well, if we had time this morning, we could discuss the division that separates non-institutional churches. There essentially were three groups of issues. Issues involving church support of institutions. By the way, all of these things had gone on for a long time. And they were debated, discussed, among brethren, all of whom were committed to just being New Testament Christians. Sponsoring church arrangements had existed for a long time. Some people thought they were all right. Some people thought they were not. And a whole generation, a lot of times people say, well, we just shouldn't have divided about those things. Actually, people did not divide for a generation. Various social gospel kind of issues. Whether churches ought to be involved in providing recreation and entertainment. Do you know that? That's a fairly recent issue. All of these, actually, are fairly recent issues in Christian history. If you go to New England, and tour New England, go to a New England old Puritan meeting house sometime and see if you find a gym or a fellowship hall. I'll tell you what a church building was for Puritans. It was a meeting house because that was the business of the church, to meet. So all of these issues became divisive. I'll tell you why they became divisive in just a second. I have a slide here. That issue heated up. It's hard to mark a time when you say that this separation pretty well is over with. B.C. Goodpasture and the Gospel Advocate did a series beginning in 1954 that was known as the Quarantine the Antis issue, in which he essentially named people who had taken these non-institutional positions. Brother Goodpasture was a good friend of mine. He was kind of my mentor and looked upon me as his protege, because his son was my best friend, and since his son had an IQ of about 75, the good pastor liked me because we had good discussions. All right, done. Scratch that from the tape. He was a good guy. But anyhow, the time came, good pastor said, these people are destructive, they're doing harm, and they need to be isolated. And they were isolated. So that by the middle of the 50s and into the 1960s, if you took positions that questioned those things, you were pretty well quarantined. A lot of people got fired. Many preachers had to start over again. You know, in the early days of Church of Christ, the early 20th century, when Church of Christ got started and separated from Christian churches, I believe that there was a time when there were fewer than 10 supported preachers in church, working in churches of Christ. Actually, at the end of the 1950s, I believe there were probably fewer than 20 or 25 full-time supported preachers in non-institutional churches. So it was a separation in which many of us had to start over. And I'm sure Dee did. I helped establish a lot of congregations. We met in my house, and we met in other people's houses, and we met in store buildings, and we met in the courthouse, and we met in the jail one time. My wife used to teach the little kids out in the hall when they were bringing the prisoners back and forth. And it's a little hard to keep their attention. But that was the nature of that separation. Now, I'm not going to try to talk about the issues. The issues are significant, as always. And when the time comes that people seriously raise the question about whether we're doing something that we ought not to be doing, I will tell you what you have to do. You have to biblically be willing to entertain that and to look at it and judge it on the basis of what the Scriptures say. But what I would suggest to you is that this division also has the same kind of sociological, generational nature that the 19th century division did. Post-World War II Churches of Christ were just different. They had grown. There came to be, they were proud of who they were. They were wealthier. Sidney Mead, in his Handbook of Denominations, branded Church of Christ one of the top 10 non-Catholic bodies in America. And people began to think kind of denominationally about the church. There was a spirit of denominational pride. What in my book on Churches of Christ in the 20th century, I laid that out in some detail. How there was this spirit of boosterism that we need to be sure everybody knows who the Church of Christ is. I will tell you what led me into being where I am today in a conservative church is that I saw this as a sociological generational change. I wrote a tract in 1962, which is out of print. I'm going to try to get back in print this year because it's been so widely circulated and used, called The Emergence of the Church of Christ Denomination. I actually wrote it at the end of the 1950s. And it pretty well laid out this three-way division that has taken place. It's just astonishingly accurate. Actually, I think I deserve a prophet's license. It pretty well just defines how this thing is going to take place. It was interesting that I saw it even then as not an argument about specific issues so much, although issues were discussed. But there were different people in the churches. People had changed their attitudes. It was interesting that not only did I see that, and by the way, all of the progressive historians today use that interpretation and acknowledge me as the one who has taught us that that is what was going on in the movement. Progressives in Churches of Christ have never had any problem with that interpretation. In 1966, they jointly produced a book called Voices of Concern, in which they said exactly the same thing. What they said is, Churches of Christ have become a denomination. And we need to acknowledge that we're a denomination, just like everybody else, and that we're not distinctive. And in fact, the only thing that makes us distinctive is that we're not a very good denomination. And what we need to do is to see what we can do to become a more sophisticated denomination. So, Richard Hughes at Pepperdine, who is a little bit of a protege of mine, he'll hear me talk like this, and he'll say, I believe exactly the same way. He said, you pointed out a long time ago that Churches of Christ had gotten this denominational mindset. And he said, that's exactly what I believe. So he said, I believe the same thing you do. I said, no, Richard, you don't believe the same thing I do, or you wouldn't be where you are. See, we both believe that the disease is the same, but we believe in different cures. My cure is to go back like we used to do and reemphasize our commitment to New Testament authority. Your cure is to go on and make the Church of Christ into something different from what it has been. Okay, now, the truth is, what happened in the movement is that we went through a sociological evolution, just like they did in the 19th century. And churches came to be full of people that were economically and educationally different. And consequently, many people came to feel alienated and separated. And I don't have time to talk with you about those concepts. They're really interesting concepts. I will tell you, people who are committed to this principle of restoration have typically been people who felt alienated from the world. If you're real comfortable in the world, and it's hard for us as we succeed to not be comfortable in the world, chances are you're not going to be very enticed by a biblical plea that takes us back and that makes us feel separated from the world. I'll tell you, that's been a great protection for me. I do not feel a part of the world. I feel very alienated from it. And consequently, I don't mind being different. In fact, I glory in being different. And if you lose that sense of alienation, it manifests itself in our movement in lots of different ways, which I don't have time to discuss with you this morning. But when people leave that and feel very much a part of their society and celebrate their society, that'll change your attitude toward the church. By the way, let me read these three quotes here. These are from the modern period by three different people. This is old brother W.W. Odie, who was a brilliant fellow, but a very conservative preacher. He said, the church is, he wrote this in 1948, the church is passing through a transition and becoming adjusted to the complex, highly organized social age. And this is recognized by a number of educators. Big things are proposed and performed. Denominational plans and successes are cited to inspire liberality. The simplicity of the Church of the Lord is not a suitable instrument for entering upon a centralized undertaking of such magnitude. Great centralized associations are unknown to the ancient order of things. But Brother Odie said, I'll tell you what's happening is not that we're just arguing about scriptural issues. Now see, this is a different kind of division. He says, this is not a division in which people just disagree about what the scriptures teach. But different kind of people now. There are people who want to do big things. And consequently, they make big plans that are different. Here's what one of a kind of a guy in the middle said, Cleon Lyles in 1953. When brethren air their difficulties before the world, they're obscuring the greatness of the church because of their littleness. We may not ever make such an impression on others as we would like, but the one thing within the reach of all is bigness. Now, that's a different attitude. What he's saying is, I'll tell you what we want to be is we want to be successful and big. And if we're going to do that, we have to quit quibbling about these things of exactly what the scriptures have to say. And here's what one of the early progressives said. For years we've watched our religious neighbors build fine church buildings. We saw them send their preachers by the score to foreign fields. We listened to their coast-to-coast broadcasts. Now we know that they are not the only ones who can do these things. We can too. An inferiority complex is a miserable thing. It seems that there was a time when the church had such a complex, but now we see that we have the ability, the resources, the faith, and everything else necessary to do great things. Now, I just want to tell you, folks, that what we want to do is not great things. We want to do the right things. We want to be faithful to the Lord's commitment. If we can do something good, success is wonderful. But that's not what we're about. If it is, if that's our aim, and that's our guiding principle, then we'll do things that are wrong. Now, I have to quit. So I want to tell you, I'll tell you quickly what happens the rest of the way on my chart. Non-institutional churches of Christ since the 1950s have had a more or less separate existence. This main body of churches of Christ has divided. It's dividing right now. If you read some of their papers, you will see that much of the discussion is about the nature of the division that's taking place between what would call themselves conservative churches of Christ and progressive churches of Christ. All of the educational institutions classically associated with the movement will end up in the progressive wing of the movement. And I will just tell you that the issues that divide those two are that progressives, leaders in the progressive churches of Christ, would acknowledge that we are just a denomination among other denominations, that there are many things that we need to change. They would contest the whole hermeneutical principle of can you go back and restore New Testament Christianity just based on reading the scriptures? I've been deeply influenced by modern postmodernist literary criticism and deconstruction, which would say that you can't read text and come away with a uniform conclusion about what a text means. Now, if you go to some of the lectureships, and if you understand some of the language that is said, that is exactly what these people believe. And so they think that the Church of Christ is just another denomination that needs to be improved. There's a group in the middle that is still quite loyal to the principles that the churches took in 1906. I think that many of them are very culturally denominational in their approach to what they believe. That is, they kind of have a creed. This is what the Church of Christ is. The Church of Christ is this list of things. We don't use instrumental music and we do these things. And that's not what the Church of Christ is. The Church of Christ is a body of people committed to following the authority of the Lord Jesus and being His disciples and in every time and in every age trying to commit ourselves to that principle. But at any rate, if I'm going to stop for just a second, and if anybody has any questions, I do so many things and leave so many loose ends that if I've left something that's terribly untidy, I'll be glad to react to it. Let me just quickly tell you where I think non-institutional churches of Christ are today. You know, we've been essentially 50 years now, more or less, separated. And I will tell you what has happened. We have done well. And that church is growing all over this country. A lot of times people say to me, well, we're not doing very well. Yeah, we're doing real well. I can remember when in Atlanta, Georgia, was one congregation with about 75 people. Now there are probably 20, some of which have 400, 500, or 600 people. And I will tell you why that is. It's because we have been a people that are still committed to this principle. And I believe that this idea of restoring New Testament churches, that's what the world needs. It's always been the driving idea of those people who have been committed to apostolic authority. Boy, we need to not lose that. And we need to not let some group of people out here capture that idea. I mean, that is who we are. And I believe there's a market for that. If you want to know how to succeed, I'll tell you, let's take that message and tell people, here's a place where you can come, and we're just going to do what we can find in the Scriptures, and we're serious about studying the Scriptures. That'll work. And the reason things are growing is because a lot of people are leaving really liberal churches of Christ today because they don't like it. I was in a meeting in Lakeland, Florida not long ago, and standing back at the back after the service was over, and an older couple walked by, and this lady said to her husband, I could overhear him, she said, I told you if we kept looking, we'd find a Church of Christ where they talked about the Bible. Well, I want to tell you, that's what you need to be. And that needs to be our commitment. And I'll tell you another thing about where we are. We got another generation coming along. We're actually, I think, kind of in that middle generation where Joshua died. And the generation of those of us who lived through these things and had to make our decisions that were painful decisions. We're just about gone. And where churches are today is in Jacksonville, where I'm an elder, we have another generation of elders coming along. And they're good guys. And they're kind of like the generation that outlived Joshua, I think. And they know a lot about what's going on. And now then another generation is going to come along that doesn't know anything about any of that. And you know, our churches are full of people that don't have any understanding whatsoever of what has happened in our past and how we got to where we are. Actually, progressive churches of Christ are full of people that have no idea and have no prejudices and that are quite easy to talk to about, well, here's how I ended up where I am. But another generation's coming along. I was in a meeting with a group of preachers in Nashville, good young guys. And I've been to a number of these where I do work with these young preachers. They're such fine men, better than the last generation by all means. But these guys, first they were there, all they could do was complain about their elders. And what old fogies their elders were, you know, and how they were just holding everything back. And I told him, I said, well, I said, that's not a problem. I said, you just wait around. Wait around about 10 years from now, and you're going to have another generation of elders. And just wait for that generation. Because the problem with that generation will be that you'll have a group that has not been committed to this same mission that we set out for. Okay, I'll end with one thing, and then see if we have a quick question. lots of times. Actually, I've done this probably for 40 years in one form or another. And sometimes somebody will come to me and say, well, you know, that's just a mess, isn't it? You put all that up there and it's such a mess. And it's kind of embarrassing to tell people that we've had all these divisions and everything else. Actually, I've never thought that was true. I've never minded just teaching an outsider this lesson, because I tell you, the lesson is I'm not loyal to history. I'm not loyal to any group. The strain that runs all through this is that there have always been people who understood that my commitment is just to the Lord. And just going back and finding out what Christians looked like in the New Testament and just doing that. And so no matter if some people come along and don't want to do that anymore, well, that takes care of itself. But what we're promoting is not our group. It's not a denomination. It's an idea of let's go back and just be New Testament Christians. And that idea is just as viable in every age. And if you're committed to it and work for it, there are people that are hungry for it. Anybody got a quick question that you'd like? Yeah.
I'm not sure how to form the question because I'm not sure of the thinking behind it. But could you address the use of the word restoration? Some say, well, you know, the Lord's church doesn't really need restoring. And so they don't exactly say, well, you shouldn't use that term, but there's something behind the thought that, you know,
yeah,
the Lord's church doesn't need restoring.
I don't particularly like the word myself, but except you got to describe it some way. I mean, there was an idea of that the church existed in the first few centuries, and then it vanished, and then it was restored in the American movement. I have a much more continuous notion of the Lord's church. The problem is, with history, somebody might say to me, well, do you know anybody who believed what you believed 1,000 years ago? Well, I can't say I do. But I don't know what almost everybody believed 1,000 years ago. And I hate to tell you, but if the world goes on another 1,000 years, nobody may know anything about you. Because I tell you what people, what we know about mostly are important people and people that have authority. So, but as I said, this idea, if you take the idea and say, well, really what we're committed to is just being followers of Christ and modeling ourselves on people in the first century. If that's what I'm loyal to, I'm just pretty sure that there have always been people that would be saying, that's what we ought to be doing. It's not what some hierarchy tells us or what somebody imagined, but we ought to try to go back to the purity of what Christians were in New Testament days. So the American Restoration Movement, I don't mind using it in that way because I can say, well, here is a sample of some people who set out to do this. But not the only sample by any means. And as I told you earlier, that's the language and thinking of the leaders of the Reformation as well. What they were out to do was to reform the church in the way that it existed in New Testament days. And I think that is a task that we have to continuously do, is to seek to reform Christianity in its pristine early form. And that's what we're doing. And you're probably not through, by the way. You're probably going to have to keep working on it. I mean, I'm pretty sure people sometimes say, well, you think you're right about everything. Well, that's correct. I do. If I didn't think I was right about something, I'd change. But what I think I'm right about today is not necessarily, that doesn't mean I'm not going to learn anything in the next, probably don't have too much longer to learn. But we keep learning all our life, keep trying to adjust to God's will. Well, if there's not a pressing comment, it's quiz time. So if you're here and you're not a Christian, quiz would be, you understand what the Lord demands of us? He just asks us to submit ourselves to His will. And that's all we're trying to do. And I can assure you, I don't have any loyalty to anything else other than that principle. When I was a graduate student many years ago at Vanderbilt in Nashville, I was a teaching fellow. I taught with seven other graduate students. And they knew I preached in a Church of Christ. And they thought that was pretty curious, that anybody with any sense would do that. So those boys used to quiz me regularly, and they'd say, well, why do you do such and such? And always I would say, well, everything I do, I just do it because that's what I find New Testament Christians doing. And I tell you what, those guys are pretty smart, of course. And they read the national newspaper regularly. And quite regularly, they'd bring something in, some article out of the newspaper, and say, here's the Church of Christ did this. And where can you find that in the New Testament? And I will tell you, they brought me some things that I couldn't find. And I'll tell you what I decided right then. I decided that I was either going to have to quit saying that I would find in the New Testament everything I did, or I was going to quit doing anything I couldn't find. And that's what I've decided, and I've made a long journey trying to do that. And I can tell you that all I stand for is that same thing today. It's just that principle. And if you know something that I ought to change, I'd be glad to look at it and change it. But that principle, I'm not going to change that. And that's what we invite people to come be a part of, that wonderful journey that begins by reading the New Testament and seeing what it took to be a Christian in New Testament days, to profess belief in Jesus Christ, to say, I want to be His disciple, turn away from our sins, be baptized for the remission of our sins, born a child of God, and then just being faithful to our discipleship. If you're in this audience this morning and you need to obey the gospel, we're going to encourage you to come. That is why we stand and sing.